And so Rothbard, then 20 years, 25 years later, built on the theories of those great Austrians to create this work. And so again, I think that's important. Of course, the central insight there, in my opinion, the central insight there is not that necessarily that it's inflation that created the depression, and that this is just an expression of a normal business cycle, as Austrians understand it. The crucial thing is to show how the economy was inflationary. I mean, we all have this sense of the roaring 20s and the you know, all these external kinds of superficial things that make it seem like there was this kind of, you know, like inflationary attitude, this kind of high time preference attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow our money's going to be worthless. And yet the money was not worthless in the sense that, it didn't go hyper, and the inflation is not that apparent. But what Rothbard shows is that, and they weren't printing money, that's the other part of it, but what Rothbard shows us is that this almost the whole inflation was taking place by means of credit expansion. And then in that gritty section that we read about in terms of what kind of credit was expanded and in what ways and at what times and for what reasons, that I think goes to the heart of the issue. And we see there Rothbard following as a kind of detective, following these things down to their original happening. It's quite a brilliant a piece of work in so many ways. Of course, the reason that in Rothbard's analysis, the reason that you don't get a completely different price for money or a completely different depreciation of the currency is that productivity increases in this booming period. And so there's an increase of productivity that basically takes up the slack of a constant inflationary binge. And so you have these things happening together, and then it works into the normal business cycle that we have been over and that we've read about, and that is sort of basic to the Austrian understanding of the way the modern world works, namely that there's a boom, there's an inflationary boom. In this case, it was through a credit expansion for the most part, or almost completely. There's a boom, 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 and at some point, then it has to correct. And so Austrians insist that the correction has to happen. And at the time, in 1929, 30, 31, 35, Mises and Rothbard were saying, well, of course, you just have to let this correct, because there were these false signals given to the market, and so people made decisions based on false information, because governments were expanding currency, creating inflation, and therefore all this has to correct. And all of the bad things that happen in a depression, people, if they've sold their lives, they've sold a home place and moved to somewhere where there's a factory where they can make a lot of money because the factory is hiring a lot of people at high wages, and then depression happens, factory closes down, they're out of work. Well, all of this human suffering doesn't go back to it really is not as much the fault of the factory owner who made a kind of malinvestment, because the factory owner was looking at the market, which was distorted by the printing of the inflation of the economy, of the currency. So that's how it works. In other words, there's this whole process that happens, and so all of the depression kind of ideologies that come out of this, the sort of social democracy and so many intellectuals who went over to Marxism or communism or who even became communists, they're looking at poor people with this sort of depression, this joblessness, this hunger and all that, as a sign that that capitalism has done these people wrong. Well, it is a kind of capitalism. It's a state capitalism and a sort of welfare corporatism that does it. So that's a really important element of Rothbard as well. I jotted down a couple of things that I was going to add to this. Here's this. I think I ended up putting it in. Okay, so I think that's what I would say about the Rothbard reading. I mean, it's just a brilliant piece, and I think I've described in general what happened in the Depression. Now, if you go off and look in a history textbook about the Depression or an economics textbook, if you look on Wikipedia, they will talk about several causes, and most will not mention this cause at all because the mainstream is still so solidly entrenched in people. And for example, fellow historians of mine who are, you know, they're my age, they went through grade school hearing all this statist interpretation. They've all read The Grapes of Wrath. They all know, I mean, they know, you know, an enormous amount of knowledge about what happened in the Depression to people. But, of course, they have this framework in their mind that's been put in there. It's very hard to get rid of. So, I mean, this is an idea that that is difficult. But on the other hand, if Austrians have kind of declared open war on Keynesianism, this is a really good opportunity, in my mind, to attack Keynesianism at its root and to say, okay, well, here's the mainstream interpretation, the statist interpretation, but look, it doesn't work. And so here's an interpretation that actually works perfectly. It interprets the events in a seamless way. So I think that's a very important part of all this, too. Well, I wait for my slow slide to change, and maybe I'll see it in a minute. I don't know if it's changing faster for you than for me. It may be really ripping for you, but it's kind of sluggish for me. So, the fact of the matter is, one of the great things that Rothbard gives us, and I wanted especially for us to read that section on Hoover. And one of the services he does in this book is to show us that Hoover was actually just Roosevelt Jr., basically, that Hoover was an interventionist. He started out as an interventionist. He had planned to create as much interventionism in government as he could. Herbert Hoover was in the section we didn't read. Rothbard takes him up a little bit, and in general, I don't know if you know the biography of Herbert Hoover, but he was an engineer who really came to the fore as a sort of manager of people during World War I, and he got put in charge of all of the war relief activities of the United States and eventually internationally too. And he disposed over enormous funds, over an enormous organization, and he got to be one of these progressives who sort of saw in himself the kind of technocratic leader of the masses. And so he came back and applied these insights to changing the fabric of society here as well. So that's important, too, to understand the role of Hoover as a kind of preparatory person for Roosevelt. Okay, well, did the war get us out of this Depression? I mean, this is the next thing. If everybody knows one thing and one thing only about the Depression, I mean, you can ask your uncle as he's watching football, and or you can ask a 7-year-old kid if they've ever, maybe they haven't heard of the Depression, but it's like Marie Antoinette. People know one thing about Marie Antoinette, and that is that she said, "Let them eat cake." And she didn't really do that. So they know only one thing about her, and that one's wrong. So here, too, people tend to know only one thing about the Depression, that the war got us out of it, and that's wrong, too, because I have the answer all set out in the next slide, which is going to be slow in coming, but it's going to be good when it gets here. So we'll have to wait for it. But the answer is, of course, I'm waiting for it. That's it. The Depression, as Higgs in a rather a brilliant analysis, and in other work that Robert Higgs has done since he wrote that article in the 90s, the Depression didn't end when the war started in certain important senses. Unemployment went down, but on the other hand, 400,000 of the either the unemployed or the potentially unemployed were actually killed in the war. So in that sense, we do cut down on unemployment, but it's not a way that most of us would want to deal with the problem. Well, let's just take the unemployed or some number equivalent to that and kill those people off. It's also the fact that there's no sound basis for any of this, that there really is a kind of inflationary trend. There's not so much inflation apparent during the war, but as Higgs shows, but there is the preparation. There is the preparation for it, and actually, it occurs in the figures if you analyze this properly. Joblessness was still, in spite of the fact that the government was employing so many people and putting so many people to work in so many essentially non-productive capacities, still in all, there were problems throughout the whole period. Standard of living, as Higgs points out, was very low. I mean, people had the sense that they were doing better than in the Depression, but in fact, the standard of living was still quite low. So this is a really important element, and again, another part of this Depression story that really gives us an interesting approach. And when I say this, I mean in talking with students, and talking with friends, and talking with in writing articles, in doing all kinds of things. I think this Depression, the Great Depression, not our current Great Recession, but the Great Depression is wonderful food for thought, in that we have this package ready to go for us. Okay. Well, what I want to do now, since we've talked about the Depression a little bit, and we could go into it in detail, but we have so many other things to do, I think we have to let that work for itself. And if you've read the book or the sections from the book, then you know a lot about the Depression. And I do recommend that you, when you have time, you go read the whole book. It's more of same, and there are more brilliant parts to it, and all that. But let's go back to Germany now. We talked a lot about Germany last week, and we know about, and we read an awful lot about Germany and its Great Depression. So let's turn and think about that. The very last thing that we talked about last week had to do with this slide that hooked together the United States as the benefactor of Germany, in that it gave loans to Germany. I mean, you don't give loans, but it extended loans to Germany. Germany was in turn supposed to A, get on its feet, B, improve its productive capacity. That was one of Keynes's ideas, that Germany needed this money to improve its productive capacity. And then eventually to get on its feet enough so that it could just start making the reparation payments to England, France, and Belgium. No reparations were owed to the United States. We weren't in on that. And so that's the idea. So the money flows to the United States, and it's supposed to go to this highly democratic, and I mean that in a real sense. I mean, it was a very democratic a government in all the good senses that it was kind of open, it had a constitution, all those things, and all the bad senses that it was a very, very much a mass democracy. And as they called it themselves, it was an interest. It was a democracy of interest, where the parties were basically lining up at the pig trough to feed there. I mean, and everybody recognized that each party, that's why I had so many parties, each represented a fairly small set of interests. And that's one reason why in the last years of the Weimar Republic, that is just before Hitler came to power, there was basically gridlock, because they couldn't get enough parties to create a cabinet and agree on enough to stay in power. So that's the status of Germany, and it is a welfare democracy, and which basically is what most democracies are. I mean, to a greater or lesser extent, in democracies, people tend to vote the property and the wealth of others into their own pockets if they can. So it was a democracy of that sort, and it went through all the horrors of the hyperinflation and the revolution, all those things we talked about last week. And then there's this period of kind of things look pretty good, they look okay, but once the money stopped flowing from the United States, not only were things not okay, but the Germans were in a terrible way, and all the major banks crashed, and suddenly, at about a 6-week or 2-month interval after the United States, then this worked its way all around, all of Europe, but Germany and Austria were especially hard hit here. And so we can take a look. I mean, to see the way that the inflation traveled to Europe, you can kind of take something from this table. If we look at unemployment rates, remember the highest rate for the United States was in 1934, and it was right at 25%. So 33, it's already 26% in Austria. It gets up to 20. It falls a little bit the next year, and then maintains a kind of 24-25%, and then gets less at the end of the 30s, especially after the Germans take over Austria. Belgium starts at 1933 at just over 20%, up to 23%, 34, also that intensive year of depression, and then backs off a little bit toward the end of the decade. France, always a different animal, always relying on a different kind of rhythm. And as we've seen, France borrowed a lot of money in World War I, but didn't inflate its currency as much, not nearly as much as Germany. Only the currency only lost, you know, 3/5 of its value in France. So they're always a little different, and they're this snapback, the correction in France wasn't quite as severe. It's still severe. 14% out of work throughout all the early 30s. Germany higher than Austria, and Netherlands. The Dutch oddly were even higher, which is kind of hard to explain. But look what happens in Germany. We start out at 26.3%, higher than it ever was in the United States. And then 1934, we get down to 15%. 1935, it's 11.6, 36.3, and so forth. Netherlands, it not only worse. Now, let me say again, warning, these are statistics that are just in a common economics textbook, and they are mainstream statistics. I wasn't trying to mine these things and make corrections and things like that. I mean, eventually, if all of us Austrians live long enough, then we will make such corrections and we'll have better figures. But this is the basic story that gets told, and it's a pretty stark kind of a story. So all of Europe is thrown into this depression. And it's not just the writings in America. I mean, there's I saw somebody mentioned Grapes of Wrath on here. Who was it, Erica's or somebody else? Yeah, Erica's up there talking about the Grapes of Wrath a few minutes ago. I mean, if you've ever read George Orwell's books from the 30s, the they're also oriented that way. There were Italian folks who were writing that way. There were other Britons who were doing the same kind of thing. In other words, hard social commentary based on the fact that they all had this this depression all over. So let's see. You know, I think I got my statistics a little bit backwards. We'll look at some more German depression statistics in a minute, unemployment statistics. But here's the key to understanding the whole rise of the Nazis and the relation of the depression to the Nazis in Europe. And that is that we had this multi-party, highly democratic, highly responsive, and very much interest-oriented, faction-oriented republic. And the thing is, it does represent, the nth degree of opinions. And so it did represent this nth degree, this 3% or 2%, all the while that Germany... That the Nazis were getting these votes. In other words, the first national election to the Reichstag or the national parliament that the Nazis actually got into was in May 1924. That's just as the to settle down in the first months of 1924. But Hitler's in, he's on trial in the spring, and then he's already. Just after this goes to jail, so that the party's in a bit of disarray. But it shows you that there's a considerable. It's a big number. 2 million people voted for the Nazis. But what happens then is that they get a percentage of the seats in the Reichstag. That's equivalent to their 6.5. This is about 510 seats in the Reichstag. You can figure that out. What is that? You figure it out. You've got the paper and the calculator. I'm busy talking. But in other words, if you got 40% of the votes, and nobody did, but if you had 40%, you'd have 40% of the Reichstag members. You'd have 200. Okay. Well, what happens is, and you see here how things are calming down. When times are really rough, people, obviously Germans were reaching toward radical solutions. Now the interesting thing is that the solutions of Hitler were not, they were all statist solutions. Hitler started out, and when he joined the party, he even changed the platform to reflect a very, very leftist kind of totalitarianism. He was very much in the mode of a Lenin or somebody else. And he was already racist. He already had it in for the Jews in the party platform. But from the very beginning, he seems like he's kind of partly left, partly right. I mean, I know there's a problem with those definitions, but I'm just talking about what people accepted. So it was hard to tell who or what he was, except that he kept on saying, well, life is war. I mean, he was this real social Darwinist, and life is war, and he had been in a war, and he knew what war was like, and he knew that everything had to be done in a total way, in a ruthless way, or you don't get anything done. So people knew that. So it is a kind of radical solution, no matter what else whatever solution he's suggesting. And I have to tell you that early Nazis listening to the Nazis were pretty confused. Themselves. There's a famous political scientist who saw a speech, a Nazi speaker, just a local candidate, giving a speech in Schleswig-Holstein in the north, he jotted this down because it was just a funny speech. The guy said, "What do we want, my friends? Do we want higher bread prices? No. Do we want lower bread prices? No. Do we want the same bread prices? No. What do we want? We want national socialist bread prices." See what I'm talking about? In other words, there is this element there of kind of radical irrationality, and it's it's I mean, irrationality crops up in different movements of people and things throughout history and in our own time certainly. But it's really a kind of regular element of the Nazi Party. But in any case, people in this radical time, just after the big crisis of November 1923, then they vote more radical. Communists got more votes too. So people are voting more radical at that time. And then the Rentenmark comes in, people can get some food again, life begins to normalize a little bit. I mean, the middle class is wiped out or severely damaged, but in fact, it looks like there's a brighter future. And so people move back to sort of centrist parties, and so the Nazis don't get as much of a vote. Then the Nazis go intensively at it. Hitler gets out of prison. He was just in there for 10 months. No, it's kind of a house arrest type thing. And he gets out. He re-energizes the party. He rethinks it all. I'll have to tell you, he's the most thoughtful politician in the Weimar Republic. He thought of new technologies. He thought of targeting precincts that were key precincts. He thought of all kinds of modern things. He flew around in a plane. He used the radio a lot. They had Nazi film trucks, Kino Lastwagen, that would go around and show movies to people, Nazi propaganda. You know, so they did all this work. They aimed at urban workers because they thought that those workers would really give them the most vote. And part of the time, they shift and aim for. So there's all this thought and care put into the political system, and so they work hard. And what happens next is that the next Reichstag election happens. Not quite 4 years later, in 1928. And the result is that they have fewer people vote Nazi than they had previously. All right? So after all the work and all the thought and all that, and they had gone all out. He had, you know, Joseph Goebbels was already a part of the team. He was the Gauleiter of Cologne for a while. He distinguished himself so much that he became, a real assistant to Hitler in the propaganda sphere. And so all of this is happening, but they still don't get many votes. However, then the Depression happens. The Depression descends, and people just, you know, they go again out to the edges of this political system. So what happens then is that their votes go up, things get bad, more and more people are out of work, eventually about 6 million, and over 6 million people move out to the peripheries. There's a scare that the communists are going to try to take over, and the Communist Party's getting a lot of support, that's very true. And then November 1932, they begin to lose votes. Previous to this, there had been several offers to Hitler to come into a coalition cabinet. He refused. But after this election in November 32, a coalition cabinet seemed like a good idea. So eventually, they got that negotiated. And on January 31st, 1933, then Hitler took over as chancellor. And it was a coalition cabinet made up of a lot of German conservatives and then some Nazi friends of Hitler's. The next election is really not indicative of anything, and historians of Germany always called the November 1932 the last free election. I mean, it was kind of violent, and there was, you know, there were some irregularities, but it was pretty much a free and open election. Whereas March 1933 happened after the Reichstag fire in February, and there were Nazi thugs out in the streets, and there was a lot of violence, and they were already on their way to just shutting down all the parties. They hadn't done that yet, but it's in the works. And so that's not really a free election. So the 17 million is a number that we shouldn't necessarily believe, but the 11 million, the 11 or 12 million, that's certainly believable. So about a third of Germans were in favor of Hitler when they were free to kind of pick and choose, and that's the that's something to remember too. But you see the trajectory here of the Depression and what happens then. Well, okay, Hitler takes over, and what's the economic program? Well, he's a statist. I'll have to tell you, if you think about what Germany did in World War One, if you think about the command economy, the redefinition of confiscation, if you think about all the ways in which basically the Hindenburg program of World War One created a model for Lenin, which actually Lenin freely admitted. He said this in a meeting of the Council of People's Commissars. You know, the Germans, they figured this out. That's the kind of government we want. We want a total war government. We'll call it war communism. So that was the way things went. But Hitler's program then seems to succeed. By 1939, there's virtually nobody out of work. Now, again, these are Hitler's figures, or the German figures from that time. And a lot of commentators have pointed out that, well, okay, yes, here, this really doesn't mean all these, that there weren't jobless people. It's just that you'd taken out of, you know, the equivalent number of jobless people and put them into Dachau and Buchenwald and these concentration camps all over Germany, which would be, I might add, exactly the same argument as Higgs's argument in terms of taking people out of the jobless area. So, I mean, it's an argument that I accept completely. So I don't think there were as many out of work. But clearly, Hitler is using similar spoken. Mirrors to what Roosevelt is using. They're both statists. They both use the public. You see what he's doing. Can you try to read? Using you try to read. Let me check that one. Let's see if that does it. I'm not sure I've shut it down completely. Cliff, you may have to tell me how to restart this completely. I've forgotten exactly what to do to restart the audio-visual. Let's see. Okay. Choppy, but here. Wow, there's nothing showing wrong here except that, okay, click on the triangle, okay, is the video, okay, Jeff says the video's fine, Erica says it's working now, it is smoother, it's okay, is it good enough to go on with? It's all okay. Wow. Okay. Very good. Okay. All right. Thanks, Cliff. Appreciate it. Good work. All right. Well, let me know, and I'll try to pay attention to the. Actually, Cliff can when he blips that special message up there, I can see that that better. Let's see. Back up in the lecture to the point just after you said putting people in concentration camps. Lord, okay. Well, I mean, my point about that was, very good, thank you. My point about that was that this argument is now made about, well, heck yeah, there was less unemployment because, you know, several hundred thousand were in Buchenwald or Dachau or one of the concentration camps. And that is exactly the same argument that Robert Higgs uses when he says that, well, you know, all these people were either dead or in the army or taken out of productive employment to do some government job. So it's the same argument. So what my point is that I think it's a good argument, and I think that that these figures don't reflect the absolute reality. We'd have to put back into them. I wonder if actually maybe some plot. Maybe somebody doesn't want me to say these words. Well, I'll stand up for truth, and I'll say no. I'm kidding. The fact of the matter is that these figures don't reflect the reality. I mean, and eventually you're gonna haul away people to concentration camps. You're gonna kill people and all that. And then all the time say, well, we didn't have much unemployment. So that's a part of that. That's a part of that whole story too. So I'll just go to the next slide, and it may get dicey here. Maybe I suspect the PowerPoint is part of the problem. So I'm going to let this really load in before I start talking. Let me give it just a little bit of a break. Okay, I hope this one has come up for you, and I hope that you can hear me. Okay, well, I've just shown these comparisons, but again, our figures are... I think our figures are still a little bit cooked here, but it is an interesting thing because, you know, in American history, this is the big moment of American agony and so forth. But the great, you know, depression. Except that Hitler and Roosevelt came to power at the same time, used these very, very similar measures. I don't remember if I got that said, but maybe that's something I skipped when the voice was choppy. I'll say it again. You have exactly similar measures going on in the United States and in Germany. For every Hoover Dam and Grand Canyon and public works progress of that sort, you have an Autobahn going on in Germany. And for every Tennessee Valley Authority, you have an equivalent thing going on in Germany. There's one slight difference, and that is that Hitler's public works programs all worked together with his rearmament. So a lot of people went back to work with rearmament that was sponsored by inflationary measures in the economy or various little shifts and dodges with credit and foreign exchange and so forth, taking money from people and then putting back into rearmament and then employing people like that. So it's a similar kind of smoke and mirrors game, and Hitler's projects are very much tied into the whole kind of rearmament type situation. So anyway, you see these comparisons, but one way or the other, even the smoke and mirrors worked better in Germany. I mean, that's something to remember. Okay. What happens in Germany is that that Hitler keeps on talking like he doesn't want inflation and he fears the inflation and so forth. But regardless of that, and he's got Schacht in there as his Minister of Economics up to 1937. Who seems to be, we know him from last week. He's this sort of Keynesian economist who helps, at least in his own mind, save Germany by creating the Rentenmark. But he's really a kind of flexible bunk. And then Schacht is working here, and what happens is that banknote circulation just simply goes way up. It more than doubles over a 6-year period. Total government expenditure is way up. In other words, there are all kinds of inflationary factors, but the government is clever enough to cover those over and to make it so that we don't get a kind of out of control appearance. We're all putting this off to pay in the future. We're putting it all off to pay in the future, but in fact, that's for the moment, people seem somewhat happy. Although, if you read that good little piece, the review of the biography of Hitler, then you know that in fact there are all kinds of things going wrong. There were some real food protests. People understood that their standard of living was low, and so forth and so on. But in any case, things don't seem to spin out of control until the actual war starts, and then there are price controls and wage controls, and all the wartime stuff just starts immediately once World War II started. It's also a theory that a possible theory that Hitler was, because of this unrest in the economy, because of the economic parts of the program, that this pushed him to go to war sooner. And I would, some modern historians, especially the British ones, tend to reject that argument. But I think most American historians of Germany, even from the mainstream, would accept that it was an economic driven thing. That Lebensraum was driven by racial theory, but it was also clearly a kind of economic argument, and that was related to what's happening in Germany and how you pay for all this without having to pay for it. I mean, because the Lebensraum program, that's that expansion, that sort of continual expansion for 1,000 years to the east. That whole thing is about conquest and then reorganizing the conquered peoples as some kind of slave cog in the overall machinery of the Third Reich. Well, I mean, one of these British historians who has analyzed this, H.A.P. Taylor, he died in 1990, but he's a very famous historian, a kind of rascal in some ways. But he writes this, the Nazi secret was not armament production, it was freedom from the then orthodox principles of economics. Government spending provided all the happy effects of mild inflation, while political dictatorship with its destruction of trade unions and rigorous exchange control as a rise in wages. Next page, I have a different quotation from actually another Briton, but in this case, he disagrees. In his recent book, and this is a huge biography of Hitler that Ian Kershaw has written, a summary of price and wage levels prepared for Hitler on the 4th of September 1935, for the German workforce earning gross marks or less per week. This was substantially below the poverty line. Wages then remained at the 1932 level, substantially lower than the last pre-depression year of 1928 in the much maligned Weimar Republic. Food prices, on the other hand, had risen officially by 8% since 1933. Overall living costs were higher than 5.4%. So you see, things weren't all as they seemed, there were troubles. It's an inflationary regime, but very much a modern type regime. I mean, Hitler didn't use processes that were very different, especially in the economic sphere, from anybody else on the scene. Let me talk now about all the countries. We'll move away from Germany specifically and talk about all the European countries. I don't think we have to go through all this blow by blow. We've read a lot about World War I. You know what was the standard for wartime. There were home front measures in every country that were quite similar. They varied. And the German regime, I mean, the totalitarians, they did kill a lot more people. That's true. I mean, so there's a difference in degree in some cases. But on the other hand, economic regulations, rationing, price controls, wage controls, control of workers, and so forth, this was the same or similar across the board. So there were total regimes in power that were acting totally. In other words, they acted as if they could do anything to anybody. They could take anything from anybody. And everybody owed then the state everything. And that, I mean, those with those things, that sounds like something right out of Mussolini's preaching about totalitarianism. I mean, that's what it is. So the other regimes were total too. And when the British decided that somebody was making impolitic comments and locked them up for the duration of the war and sometimes for their life, well, that's what they did. And so the same thing goes on in Germany. It's a rougher regime. You get a lot rougher treatment in these lockups in Germany, or in the Soviet Union, obviously. And in both cases, you could end up dead. But in the United States, in Britain, and France, and still, you know, this all kind of similar regimes. Each regime used economic controls and propaganda and expropriation, and used these tools in tandem. And each regime, and if you may have read Nation State and Economy or The Omnipotent Government by Mises, he deals in great detail with ethnic hatred as a tool of the state and as basically a way to expropriate people in a very sophisticated, it seems like a really blunt way to just say, well, we hate you because you're Jews, or we hate you because you're Chinese, or we hate you because of this or that or the other, and then expropriate that group. But in fact, there's a sophisticated way in which states use this whole thing to say to everybody, well, you don't have rights either. You just happen not to be a Jew, or you happen not to be Chinese, or you happen not to be Japanese. So that's the way that the states work in this context. And then there's finally what I'm calling here the economics of inflation avoidance. It doesn't really avoid it, it just puts it off, but they're all these ways to disguise inflation without while still basically inflating, and we've talked about that before. So let me see how far my slides will go here. We're already at 9:07. I hope it's okay if we go a few more minutes here before I stop for the question and answer. I have a couple more slides to get, and we'll get a full Q&A in, there'll be no problem with that, but let me see if my slide will feed in, and if it won't, maybe it's a good place to start. We've got more stuff to go here. Okay. Well, it's these photographs it doesn't like. That's too bad. At the end of the war in Europe, really saw a busted up Europe in many places. I mean, in the countries that stayed out of the war, they did fine. I mean, in Turkey and Spain, the economies were not ruined or anything. In Sweden, the economy was not ruined. The places that had been occupied, though, were pretty much hollowed out by the Nazis or the Soviets or whoever occupied them. I mean, the United States and Britain did some occupying of their own in the Middle East and attacking Iran and Iraq to bring them into the Allied camp as friendly partners, but it took invasions to do it. And so, you know, countries are more or less ruined depending on how they were situated in the war, which side they were on, and for the most part, whether they were under the bombs of the Allies, because the Luftwaffe got wiped out pretty early in the war, pretty much at the Battle of Britain, at least the strategic parts of the Luftwaffe. So there wasn't as much bombing of Britons by Germans or of others by Germans. There was a lot. I mean, 20,000 civilians in Britain died from the bombing, but you know, nearly a million Germans died. So there's there's a lot less in Britain. But in any case, there's a lot of rubble in Europe. You could see scenes like this in a whole lot of places. These all happen to be German scenes that we're looking at here, but you could see these everywhere. And the result of this, I just want to point out, was extreme hunger. It was extreme privation. The whole system of transportation was disrupted. That in many cases, you have this enormous urban population living amongst urban technologies, and all those technologies get disrupted in some degree, and so it's very rough times for Germans. Many people starved to death. Many people thought they were going to starve to death. People rooted around among the rubble. You see those two little girls in the middle doing a typical kind of trip to figure out what they can get to wood to burn, some food to eat. The boys down on the there's some girls there too, maybe, and actually some grown-ups too. But it started with boys. That's a particular kind of activity. Germans were so cold when it got to be winter, 1945-46, that they would wait till a coal truck, usually a coal truck going someplace, you know, to give coal to deliver coal to an Allied facility. They would wait at a corner while the truck downshifted and turned the corner, and then they would hop up on there, and you see a guy doing it and just scooping out a bunch onto the ground or maybe into a sack or something. And so they would grab that coal and take it home and keep their family warm. And this was such a common activity. In 1945-46-47, that you take some like a word out of it, so they ask flinks, no German, but the conjugate flinks me as winger and flinks the flinks fling Christmas. Okay, am I back? Am I back? Barely? Yes, you're back? Okay. Am I back? All right. This is rough. Okay, well, where did I get to, somebody? I mean, I don't know how long that went, because there's all this thing, up here, back to the coal truck. Okay, yes, I was talking German after that. Okay, here we go. Well, see there, you see what they're doing there. They're sweeping coal from that truck, or grabbing, you know, trying to fill up their sack, or they sweep an armful off to scatter it on the ground and then pick it up. And there was so much of this type of thing, and so much of stealing of bread where they could find a bread delivery maybe to the Allies, and that's probably that where that coal is going. But there was so much of this sort of thing going on that there was a big discussion among the Protestant and Catholic churches of whether this was a sin or not. I mean, you know, most Germans were Protestants or Catholics, and the question was, well, you know, isn't it a sin to be stealing? I mean, we've always said it was. But one of the Catholic archbishops cut through the whole argument and said, look, I hereby declare that for the moment, under these circumstances, with people freezing to death and starving to death, that and the currency's now gone hyper, right? The currency's no good. You can't buy anything anyway. There are no goods. And so he says, okay, it's not a sin. Well, this archbishop's name was Frings. That is F-R-I-N-G-S, Frings. And so the Germans, they liked this ruling so much, and they liked to play with words anyway, but they made a verb from his name. So his name was Frings, and the verb became the verb Fringsen. And I don't know if you know German or not. I'm sure some of you do, but that would be conjugated Ich Fringse, du Fringst, er Fringst, wir Fringsen, ihr Fringst. Sie Fringsen. So anyway, that's the story there. It was a very, very grim time, and if I'm sure many of you could tell stories about the Germans you've talked to. I've been in Germany quite a bit and talked to a lot of people, and people were really right on the edge of starvation throughout that whole time. So It's pretty massive privation. Now, let me see if I can change the slide or if it will cut us off. Let's check. Let's try it. Wow. Okay. I hope you can hear me. Okay. Listen, there's a good article. If you want to read more about the actual way that the currency, when the currency, I mean, there was a huge inflation. In all this confusion of the technology, I forgot to mention, all hell broke loose. The German Reichsmark, the minute the war is over, it's pretty much worthless. The Allies come in, they see that it's worthless. Eventually, they introduce what they call a scrip. S-C-R-I-P. They introduced the Allied scrip, and that's supposed to circulate along with whatever Rentenmarks and Reichsmarks are still out there. But there's all kinds of inflationary pressures. The Allies print up a bunch. The Russians print up reams and reams of Allied scrip. And so basically, there is this hyperinflation yet again. After all is said and done, not only are people in extreme privation, but there's this hyperinflation that goes on that makes it even worse. And so they do reform the currency. It's this currency reform that touches off the Berlin blockade. That's the reason for the Berlin airlift. That's in 1948. And there's a good article on this currency reform by Günther Thumann. And it's online, and so I've just stuck this up here in case you want to know more about it. I've summarized a little bit of it, but he points out these things: that war damage in Germany at the end of the war, in terms of manufacturing production, there was less than 60% of the 1936 level, and so per capita consumption was at about 2/3 of 1936. There was severe scarcity throughout Germany of the most basic goods. Public debt at the end of the war was at about 400% of 1939. Thumann says cash and demand deposits of the non-bank sector, M1, had increased by almost 500% between 1935 and 1945, while GMP had dropped by more than 40%. There were the minute the war started. In fact, just before, there were price and wage freeze to completely. Is the sound off again? Oh man! Can somebody give me a hint? Jeff says no sound. Is there sound? Okay, sound is good somewhere. So there's this freeze from 1939 onwards, and basically basically the Reichsmark had lost its function as a means of exchange. But there is good news at the end of that, and I'll tell you what, this thing is so persnickety, I'll just get the rest of the story in next week. We'll stop here for 3 or 4 minutes. We'll have our full question and answer, and some more things will come out in that. But what happens next is the currency reform has to do with a great hero of the 20th century, and there aren't many in the political sphere, but we are going to find one in this context. So let's do this. I will take a 3-minute break, and I'll be right back. Okay? See you then. If you think I should get off and get back on, if you think that might help, then I'll be glad to do it. What do you think? I wonder if anybody can hear me. Okay, how do I do that, Grayson? How do I go microphone only? What if I dump my presentation? Do you think that is... See, I think every problem was when I changed and the presentation kind of hung up. Shall we go until it messes up and then try to fix it? Static. Wow. Okay. All right. That sounds fine to me if you want to just... Okay, let's see if you can hear me now, because Cliff has assigned the mic only to me. Okay. All right, very good. Well, let's jump in then. Great audio, no video. Yeah, that's what it's supposed to be. They have, you can just play like I'm that woman with the headphones on. So, questions, comments, things that you didn't hear while the audio was bad? Greg asks, since World War I and World War II are so closely related, along with their economic ramifications, have any historians simply treated them as one large 25-year war economic mess? Well, actually, a few historians have done that. I mean, at this stage of the game, it's they still seem to like two distinct things to most historians, but it has occurred to me that, you know, in 50 or 100 years, there's going to be a lot more thinking about the, I don't know, what you call it, maybe your designation is good, the 25-year war of the 20th century or something like that, because it really is just a kind of continuation with this somewhat peaceful time in the middle. But yeah, that's really the case. And economically, the two are just bound together. And they're bound together in a lot of other ways, too. To tell you the truth, all the war leadership and the ideas of the war in each country, they just sort of flow from one to the other. So it's really a continuity. That's certainly true. That's a good point, Greg. How do we know Rothbard is right? I mean, there must be history books that present the Fed's work in the 20s in a more positive and noble light. My guess is that Bernanke is reading something else. Well, I mean... As human beings, we're not we're not completely certain of anything, right? I just don't think that any of the other. I mean, this is why this is how I know that he's right, and I don't know it in the sense that a kind of ultimate logical sense, but or ultimate being, I think, therefore I am, a sort of Cartesian way. But I do think that this is the only explanation of it I've ever seen. I mean, otherwise, what you're stuck with is a kind of unknowable waves of this, and optimism happened, and mass psychology happened, and And it just doesn't make very much sense to me. I mean, so that's why I think it's true. I think it's the only really rational explanation that makes sense of the whole thing, and sort of explains all the details as well. Okay, so that'd be my answer, Brad. And Grayson rightly says that Bernanke believes in Milton Friedman's story of it. Yeah, I mean, I think Phil's right. It's just inductively, just in terms of the logic of the thing, I think it's overpowering. And you know, if enough people hear it, I think that someday that will become, you know, the standard explanation. But of course, there's a huge interest in not having that be the standard explanation, because then it becomes not the fault of some vague psychology or the flapper girls or the tendency of everybody to play the stock market. I've known people who landed on that. At that point, it gets to be. Basically a reading of whose fault it was, and you know, there's basically this set of villains in the piece. Whatever their intentions were personally, they were the villains. And I'm sorry, I don't know how to say your name, and I don't know where you're from, and maybe I could say your name better if I knew that. So or what type of name it is. Isurik? Or Esurich, depending. Rothbard's, I'll call you Eric, how about that? Or is it Esurich? Rothbard's explanation can explain why consumer goods industries are hit later and to a lesser degree relative to producer goods. The Keynesian explanation cannot account for this. Additionally, Rothbard's explanation can account for the robust economic growth during the latter part of the 19th century. Relatively high levels of general price deflation. That's exactly right. I mean, it explains so many things, and it explains them in detail. In other words, it doesn't just sort of lay out a reason. He uses evidence in a really brilliant way. So that's why I think the book works. I mean, having read a lot of different historical works and works by economic historians, I just think it makes more sense. Eric says more about last week's lecture, but can you talk a bit about Mises' influence in Austria around the time of the German hyperinflation? Oh, that's a good question. Also, did he think that the only way out for Germans was to print money, or was his view more like Senholz's? Mises had a role in the Depression in Austria, and of course Austria just quickly, of course Austria-Hungary was an ally of Germany in the war, but it was its own Austrian Empire. We talked about that earlier, and just so everybody knows, the Allies busted up the Austrian Empire, and so Hungary became independent with a lot of land taken away from even what it had been. Austria became independent with a lot of land taken away, and all the other areas of the empire became these independent countries. But Austria was just a very, instead of being the head of a huge empire, was just a very tiny empire. And the country was highly socialistic. The urban areas had huge social democratic parties in them. And then basically most of the other people were in something called the Christian Social Party. And so, basically, these were parties, one of which was officially atheist and Marxist, and one of which was officially more or less Catholic. And so, there were a lot of conflicts in the party system, as you could see just from that. And so where Mises, a person like Mises stood, in other words, a secular person, I mean, he was Jewish, but he didn't have really religious affiliations that made any difference in the political system. And where he stood was at a point of saying, okay, does the country go communist does the Bolshevik Revolution, which actually tried to take over Hungary in 1919 and could easily have stepped over the border and just, you know, brought even Soviet-style aid to Austrian communists. He said, do we see civilization go down the tubes, or do we work against it? And how do we work against it? So Mises, as the at that time he had become the head of the Austrian Chamber of Commerce, and he worked with everybody. He worked, he tried to talk to the socialist president of Austria. He tried to talk to the Christian social head of Austria. He wrote, he talked, he persuaded, he cajoled. I mean, he was really, you know, when you hear Lou Rockwell or somebody talk about Mises being a hero, and there's some good writings on that, this is one of his heroic moments when when basically he, you know, it was a time when he did everything he possibly could to persuade folks not to just throw away the economic system and adopt some kind of Soviet style or quasi-Soviet style Austria. And to an extent it worked. In other words, to an extent the leaders listened to him. And in Austria, the hyperinflation didn't go the way it did in Germany because of some slightly better policies influenced by Mises and his friends. And so that's a part of that story. It's really exciting part of the story. Partly gets told to us in different ways. There's a little bit in some of Mises's autobiographical pieces, and Margaret von Mises tells a little bit about that, and some others do too. But it is indeed a fascinating kind of story. I don't remember what he thought about the rent in Marx. I mean, he knew it was only a halfway measure, but I can't recall whether he has, in his comments on that, he agreed with Senholtz or not. I mean, in the end, you know, they printed them anyway, whatever he thought about, but okay. Yes, that's true, Eric. Otto Bauer was a friend. Okay. All right. So, how many do we have on here? 15. Okay. Max Weber, yes. Exactly. Okay. So, where would you like to go from here? This was about the time, by the way, I mean, since there's no questions up, that in the, and I mean in the early 20s, that Mises met Margit, who was a retired opera singer, and he met her at a party in Vienna, and she asked somebody, she said, well, who is that man over there? And somebody said, well, that man is the greatest mind in Austria. That's Ludwig von Mises. So they had this very interesting kind of romance that went along for years. It was basically a kind of platonic and protective kind of thing. They didn't get married, and they didn't live together, but they were constant companions, and he became a kind of father figure to her daughter, and so forth. But they got married then in the early 30s, after about 8 or 9 years of him being a regular feature of their life. And by the way, the young daughter of Margit von Mises was named Brigitte, and she became very famous for being an author herself. She eventually moved to Britain, and her name is Gita Sereny, Sereny. That was Margit von Mises' name. And so, I mean, from her previous marriage, she was a widow. And Gita Sereny has written a couple of absolutely wonderful books well, more than that, but a couple of them that are really classics in German history. One's about the commandant of Treblinka, and another is about Albert Speer. And there's a great book called Albert Speer and His Battle with Truth. So I recommend that very, very highly. And if you read that big, huge 800-page book, also you can find Hayek in there. Not Mises, but Hayek, mentioned by Albert Speer, of all people. That's a very interesting thing. But I thought that was funny that he's in an interview, Speer mentioned Hayek to Gita Sareni. I wonder if she said, hey, my stepfather is Ludwig von Mises. Okay, let's see. Where are we now? Brad says, was Hoover influenced by Keynes? It seems like on the timeline he is running down the same path before Keynes. Yeah, I think you're right, Brad. I mean, I think that these are all... I think that in a way Keynes was, you know, like so many of these folks whose names come to mean, you know, something general like that. He was kind of summarizing the thoughts that were already out there. I mean, to tell you the truth, a lot of this stuff was already in the writings of Woodrow Wilson and all the other progressives in America, and it was in the writings of the Webbs in England, and it was in the writings of the people that Mises called the socialists of the chair in Germany. I mean, it was all over the place. So yeah, there's a lot of influences here. And there are folks, there's a whole group of ideologues who get into government in all these places in exactly the same way. So I think they are sort of running along the same roads. But it would not surprise me at all if Hoover didn't know Keynes from Paris. I mean, they were both at the conference at the same time. And to tell you the truth, now that I think of it, I would be surprised if Hoover was not an acquaintance of Keynes. Whether or not he got ideas from him, that's harder for me to say. So Grayson puts down, this looks like a quotation, let's see. Oh, it's from Guido Hulsmann's book on Mises. And he says, Mises felt it. It was necessary to return to the subject of exchange rate determination after World War I because the continued prevalence of the balance of payments doctrine had Austria well on its way to hyperinflation. In the feverish days of 1919, he wrote a paper on Zahlungsbilanz und Wechselkurse, the balance of payments and exchange rates, which proved to be influential in turning Austrian monetary policy away from the path of hyperinflation before it was too late. So that's good information. Very good. That's very helpful. Or Keynes by Hoover. That could be too, Phil. I'm just going in order here. I hope you don't mind. Robert says, Mises seems to level some well-founded criticism on entertainers, particularly of the anti-capitalistic mentality. Did he exclude opera singers? Well, he may well have done so. Yes. One of my favorite... scenes is from a fairly grim time in the life of Mises when he moved to America and he moved to Switzerland from Vienna, you know, sort of one step ahead of the Nazis, and then he taught in Switzerland for I forget, is it 2 years or 3 years, and then eventually made his way to New York and there lived with Margaret and taught at for a while at the New School for Social Research, and then got a bit, you know, some other bits and pieces of work here, but he didn't get an appointment as any kind of a faculty member. And he had written all these blockbuster treatises of economics, and he was, you know, his student Hayek was, you know, this superstar internationally, and so. So it's not the best time in his life, but it's a time where he begins intensively to rewrite and to write, and he's writing Human Action and all that. So there's some great scenes in this from when Margaret, and she tells us this in her little autobiography, My Years with Ludwig von Mises. She says he would he was in his study, and that was sacrosanct. He would write in there, and he would allow her to come in sort of mid-morning to bring coffee in, and then she had to leave. And so here's the great man in there writing, sequestered, and Margaret comes in and brings him coffee. I don't know. It's just a funny scene. I've tried and tried to get my wife to agree to do this, but somehow it never quite works out. The coffee always comes with some request for me to fix the front door or to carry out the trash or something like that. It's not. It just doesn't work the same when you transfer this from 1940s New York. That maybe it's the personalities involved. Who knows? Okay, let's see. So, let's see. I moved to Mises. Let's see. That was Roberts. Now I'm to Jeff. Why isn't Mises paid attention to by mainstream economists, historians, and philosophers? Well, Jeff, this is similar to questions that were asked early in the course, and you know, I've given a couple of long answers related to this, but I'll be glad to deal with it again. I mean, for one thing, most academics are really creatures of the state. I mean, most academics, whatever they say about their independence of mind or, you know, kind of getting back at the establishment or something like that, they're pretty much paid either directly or indirectly by the state. I mean, my college is a private college and all that, but you know, they take plenty of government money and they go by the federal rules and the state rules and all those things. And in graduate school, that's even more the case, because all graduate schools then are pretty much these creatures of the state. And some academic disciplines are more related. They're even more kind of ensconced in that rentier class, you might say, that class of people who are very close to the largesse of the government. And, you know, political scientists and economists, these disciplines, these people in these disciplines really are folks who are very close to that class. I mean, you think about the economists that we know. They're the ones who are always going to the White House for dinner and so forth and so on. And there's a reason they're going to the White House for dinner. It's because they've enhanced the image of the state in some way. So there are a number of reasons why Mises is not paid more attention to. But that's one of them. Okay? You know, I give a second answer to that, Jeff, and that is... I'm reminded of a passage in a big, huge, enormous book, 1,700-page book on the German inflation by a prominent historian who just died a couple years ago from Berkeley. And Mises appears twice in the 1,700 pages, and he is so dismissive both times. I mean, it's just absolutely amazing. So this fairly ephemeral historian, and he's written a lot of books and he's well known, but he's a fairly ephemeral historian from the standpoint of, you know, of his, you know, in 10 or 15 years his books will all be outdated and so forth, and yet he's sitting making judgments because, I don't know, because maybe he, you know, took economics in college and believed all his professors. So I don't know. It's a question that, you know, that we all ask ourselves a lot, and it's a good question to think about. So those would be my answers for the night. I might have different answers on a different night. So ask me again in a couple weeks. Okay. Brad asks, do you know anything about the character of Strong and Melton? It seems they were working outside the bounds of their positions, which makes me wonder if there was a breach in their character similar to Law, who wasn't the most trusted character. You know, I don't know enough about that to answer, Brad. I know what you're talking about, but I don't know any more than what's there. So yeah, that's a very good question. So many of these characters, well, they're baffling. In other words, these people who really did some damage, they're very baffling. I mean, some were kind of scoundrels. I think that sort of privately, Keynes was a kind of scoundrelly type of character in some ways. And other people who sort of pushed this program were sort of scoundrelly. But some of them, you know, lived pretty much, pristine kind of life. But it's interesting. I don't know about those two. And Grayson adds that Mises uses choosing between opera shows to illustrate an economic concept in human action. Oh yeah, well, I mean, the thing about any cultured person in the German world in Central Europe is that they have, I mean, even these days, even in these grim, dark days, Germans will often tell you that they have something called a Kulturbedarfnis. That is to say, they have a need, it's almost like a physiological need for culture. And so, I mean, right, you know, German punk rockers, maybe they don't accept that, and maybe just your average, Joe Blow or Hans Blow on the street doesn't really accept that. But for people who are educated, people who come from the kind of what they used to call Bildung, you know, real education in Germany, they all believe that you should know about painting, that you should know about sculpture, that you should know about opera, that you should know all the symphonies backward and forward, that you should have the text of Der Fliegende Holländer in your mind, and all these things. And so Mises was in favor of that. And you know, that's one of the elements. I mean, he thought that this is one of the things he was fighting for, and he says it repeatedly in his writings, that what we're working for here is civilization. It's not just that this sort of efficiency of society is, well, that's an okay thing and all that. He repeatedly says what's at stake here is civilization. And to him, all these components, I think went into that kind of thinking. Now let me see if I can get. I'm having a time getting up to now. The questions passed me while we were. Let me see. Oh, there we go. Oh, gotta get up there. Why am I not getting the rest of that? Okay. Hang on. You know, it occurs to me, I'm trying to get it back up to the question. It occurs to me that actually we have on here Robert Anthony Peters, who's on very much at the moment. I don't think he's dropped off for bad sound or something, but I saw his website on the bottom of his email, so I looked him up, and he does a talk on freedom and the arts, and I'd like to know more about that sometime, so I'm going to write to him about that. So anyway, I hope you didn't mind me saying that, Robert, but you've undoubtedly thought a lot more about this this whole opera question than me. Okay, let's see. I'm having a hard time seeing the ones at the top. Okay, there's a quotation. Robert says thanks, and then okay. Then Phil comes up in favor of the old classical system, trivium quadrivium. Grayson says. the quotation, let's see. Let me just read it out, see what we got here. The United States was in a different situation altogether. Britain could not coerce the United States into inflating in order to save the misbegotten pound, but it could cajole and persuade. In particular, it had a staunch ally in Benjamin Strong, who could always be relied on to be a willing servitor of British interests. By repeatedly agreeing to inflate the dollar at British urging, Benjamin Strong won the plaudits of the British financial press as the best friend of Great Britain since Ambassador Walter Hines Page, who had played a key role in inducing the United States to enter the war. And then there's another bit to this. Why did Strong do it? We know that he formed a close friendship with British financial autocrat Montague Norman, longtime head of the Bank of England. Norman would make secret visits to the United States, checking in at Saratoga Springs Resort under an assumed name, and Strong would join him there for the weekend, also incognito, there to agree on yet another inflationary coup de whiskey to the market. Okay, so yeah, I mean, this is and this kind of Anglophilia was not at all unusual in these circles. If you scratched any of the Morgan folks, they were all very very closely bound up with British things and British people. There's a whole fictional literature on all of this that relates rich people to living in England and marrying into the English aristocracy, as many American families, rich families, have done. So, yeah, there's a very close connection to England there. Brad says, is it fair to say that the Marshall Plan was enabling socialism? Instead of these countries having to cut the budgets of social programs, the U.S. kept them afloat. Oh, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And we will get to that next week. I had slides on that and everything. So we'll get to that next week. But that's exactly it. Greg says, got to run. Good night. Okay, good night, Greg. You're still here. No, you've left. Robert is still here. Oh, you don't mind at all. Good. Well, maybe I'll write to you then and ask more about that. That's very interesting. And Martha is interested in that too. Feel free to email. Oh, excellent, excellent. You'll be speaking at the SPN conference and at Libertopia this fall. Excellent. Very nice. Okay. And Eric says, well, Strong wanted to inflate the dollar in order to keep interest rates lower than those in London. This would keep capital flowing towards England and artificially prop up the pound while simultaneously stimulating U.S. exports. Very good. Excellent. Brad Skiles says, I read in material outside of the class that Roosevelt devalued the dollar by 40% against gold in 33-34. Was this actually an act, or simply the consequence of his policy related to gold? Gold. I'm looking down at Cliff's thing. Brad, back to your question. Well, somebody help me out here. I forgot to review this. I mean, Roosevelt did just simply take us off the gold standard, but I don't believe it was a legislative act. I think it was just simply an executive order or something. Somebody help me out here, because I'm not remembering that exactly. But yes, Brad, it was a definite thing. It wasn't just a sort of byproduct of his actions. Okay, so we're saying that Mr. Isurich is actually Emil. Is that right? I want to get the names right. I mean, but I'll say Isurich if you like. It was executive order, Grayson? Okay. All right. Erica says, could we brainstorm a bit about final projects. Though I've thought about it some, I'm still lacking a great project idea. That would be great. You can do so many different kinds of things, and Erica, you in particular did, you know, almost kind of a new art form or something. A new genre that you created. So I don't know if you're going to be able to create yet another genre, but you know, doing the same thing could be fun. As far as topics go, there's all sorts of things that that you could do for this one. I mean, for those who want to just do another sort of documentary editing job, those turned out very nicely. You know, you could do another one of those. There are all kinds of ways where you could bring, you know, either of our big wars into focus and, figure out figure out what some of these bankers were doing and what they were up to. There's a lot of people you can follow through this. You know, our William Dawes, there's an interesting character. I mean, you know, and he's so much involved in the inflationary regime at a kind of second hand, but he made his way through World War I as a pal of Pershing's and a kind of minion, a sort of poor cousin to the New York bankers, and he only became filthy rich when they told him that they couldn't really be credible in having banks take up this huge loan to England if New York bankers came, but that a Chicago banker could do it, and if he would sponsor the first big British loan in the West, that he would have untold riches before him. And so that's what he did, and then he later is, you know, part of the gang. So, you know, there's somebody like that, or somebody like Benjamin Strong, or some of these folks. Those would be ideas to work with too. Have you got ideas? Has anybody got ideas? There's 14 of us here, right? So, who's got ideas about the final project? YouTube video. Actually, we have a great one coming as soon as I get posted. There's a really cool YouTube presentation. Something like that would be good, Erica. Two readings and to hook them together in some way or other. That's great. You know, one thing I tried to do in somehow I corrupted something into my PowerPoint tonight, but one thing I tried to do was kind of pair up some quotations, and that would be a fun, I mean, you know, that's just writ small here in my little presentation here, but if you want to figure out some way of doing a presentation where you kind of counterposed opinions or something, that would be fun too, and meaningful. I mean, you know, in the end, that's quite meaningful. Grayson says, write a skit with Mises arguing to prevent hyperinflation. Well, you know, I have to tell you, skits and songs and all these things are very Misesian. You know, in the Mises circle, There's this whole literature of songs that they sang. I don't know if any of you were at the Austrian Scholars Conference a few years ago, but we performed some of those things. We did a skit that was based on some of the Mises Circle stuff, and we sang some Mises Circle. Actually, a couple of different meetings I've been in on singing Mises Circle songs. So. Yeah, Robert, that's it. Mises the Musical. Yes, I like it. Perfect. Perfect. Well, or you could, you know, you could also perform some of these songs, and they have all those. Somebody at the Institute has all those. Jeff knows where they are. They've put all those together, and they have the music and everything for the original. See, these guys would, I mean, you know, they would go for hours discussing these papers that they presented in the Mises Circle, and then they would, you know, go to the cafe and discuss more, and then things would get a little crazy, and they'd start singing, and they'd make up songs that they sang. So, you know, that maybe somebody, you know, you could cooperate, or you could record several tracks. I don't know. There'd be a lot to do there. Brad says, it would be interesting to put a timeline together on J.P. Morgan. I think so. I think that's excellent, Brad, because the biographies of him are just kind of creepy. I mean, they're just kind of fawning, and they don't really tell what you want to know. That's interesting. Okay, so there's the Mises. Yeah, that Robert does mention the unfortunate thing that the Mises musical would have a pretty small market, but it would be a dedicated market, that's for sure. Skit with finger puppets. Well, that's an interesting one. Brad, maybe you could do a finger puppet skit with your man, I forget his name, your guy from the Greenback episode. Was that stuff recorded? Oh, I doubt it, Cliff. I mean, these were in wild moments, in evening sessions. But Grayson's—he's right. He's all over it. There's the songs of the Mises Christ, the Mises Circle. Let's see. Sunshine for Hitler in Germany. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, they're really good, and I don't know, is the music there? In following that link, is the music there? I hate to hit it because it might just throw me off the internet, so I'll wait. Anyway, yeah, I understood, Phil. I got it. The producers, yeah. Martha says no sound. I'm sorry. Okay, now you do too. Very good. Hyperinflation. Interpretive dance. It's funny you should mention that. Actually, I interpretive danced for a class one time. Now, it wasn't on hyperinflation. It was on imperialism, but it was almost as good as hyperinflation would be. So, anyway. Let's see. Yes. If that's what you mean, Phil, by the question marks. Yeah, hyperinflation. Well, you could do an interpretive dance. And if you, I would insist that if you did that for your project, it would have to go on YouTube, and your real name would have to go on that. I guess that would be like, you know, sort of natural control on that. Naturally, okay, excellent. Phil's ready to go. Well, I look forward to seeing it. Okay, Brad says. He writing an article came up with this. How is it possible that we have stable prices? First, let's make a point. The average price of regular gasoline was $2.50 the week of June 1. 1 year later, it was $2.67, a 6.9 increase. Milk during the same period inflated 39.8%. Meanwhile, the government reports the CPI increased by 1.5% from June to June 11th. Which inflation reporting seems to reflect your experience? Well, I agree with Cliff on the problem. It's that, you know, there's no such thing as stable prices, and also things. You know, it depends on what avenue the inflation comes to your product, and it has to do with you know, so many what you'd call just imponderables, that it's hard to figure that out. At least I can't figure it out. It's too imponderable for me. So, yeah, I think that's a great question. Mad cow disease, possibly. Well, let's see. Okay, here's another question. Hunt, are you planning any classes for the future? I have not. I have not. I don't have anything planned. I don't plan not to do any. I just don't have anything planned. I think they're gonna. They'll probably wait. They're probably waiting to see if all of you angrily storm the Mises Institute at the end of this to burn it down because they put on this class by me. So I guess we'll have to wait and see the results of that. Earhart, Jeff says, Earhart had the same arguments from statists that we hear now. Why is the Earhart example not persuasive for Obama and the whole left? I don't know. I mean, I don't know why not. I mean, he's the great hero in this, and somehow he could talk to people and make them understand. But I don't know the answer to that, Jeff. I mean, I think it's a good question too. Thank you, Martha. I appreciate that. I appreciate it. I'm sorry the sound is somehow bad for you tonight, but and thank you for the kind words anyway. Phil's already put the torch to the building. Thank you, Erica. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Well, I didn't say that to get you all to say these things, but I like it. I mean, I'm not going to say, oh, I don't like this. Well, next week I'll somehow test my slides out before I put them on here. I have an account, and sometimes I have tested them out, but I'll make sure I do that the next time. So, well, good night, Phil, and Emil. Thank you for joining us. Right, Emil? Is that? Am I right on that? So Grayson can't find the faculty performing a Mises play, but we did it, and I played a small but important role in that play, and I played the role of a person from Harvard, so I used an excellent Harvard accent in that little skit. So, but I doubt that it's on film anywhere. I kind of hope it's not. Let's see. Oh, you're talking about a more recent performance. Excellent. Very good. Very good. I'm glad to see they've done it more than once. Let's see. So Phil's gone. Danny's left. Let's see. Margaret, no. Let's see. What if you put them online before the lecture so that we can download them, since your photo choices are great? Well, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll do that next time, just to make sure that there's no problem with it. Okay? Okay, let's see. So Phil, now he is going, after he's left that little bombshell. Okay, he's gone. Let's see. Cliff says, Brad, well, there's a great quote in Human Action where Mises explains that money, by its very nature implies a state of change. Unfortunately, I cannot find it. Okay. And is that some kind of link? Okay. I'm looking up this link. Since I don't see a question on the board right now. Oh, that's the rap. Oh yeah, absolutely. That's the rap video. Yeah. Yeah, that's terrific. Okay. So Cliff, Erica, Mises Musical. Okay. Jeff, why didn't the U.S. military learn from their own experience in West Germany and apply the Erhard solution to Iraq? Any clue? Well, I mean, because nobody knows that story. See, the story in all textbooks and among all Americans when they talk about the occupation of Germany is that that was our big chance to do nation building. And so instead of having it such that the Allies were killing and strangling Germany after it was already been killed, after it had already been, you know, wiped out in the war, then the Allied myth is that they gave Germany democracy and taught the Germans how to have a good economy and so forth. Now, it is true that there was an American committee that designed the way to do currency stabilization, and we'll talk about that at the beginning of next week's. But the idea for the currency and the idea for the opening up the market and taking away the controls, that was all Germans, in fact mostly Erhard's. So again, there's a cover story for this that's basically the reason that that there's not more awareness of it. It takes a lot of knowledge of even a lot of people who are my colleagues in German history and in the 20th century and who know, you know, have been in some documents. Even a lot of those people are kind of, they just have blinders on when it comes to it. But it's the Germans who regenerated Germany. I mean, that we had certainly an influence, but it was mostly to the bad. Okay. So, all right. Any more questions? We're kind of getting to the late hour. We have 10 or 11 left in the class, and that includes. What, Grayson and Cliff and me. Thank you, Robert. Thank you. Pear, thank you. Good night, Martha. Good night to you. So, well, Cliff, I guess we're gonna call it a night. So, thanks, Jeff. Thanks very much. Good night. Brad, same to you. Thanks again. Good night. Okay. Thank you, Cliff and Grayson. Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Good night, Erica. Good night, David. Oh, thanks very much. Okay. Oh, thanks, Grayson. Appreciate it. I think the problem is this. It was my PowerPoint, because I've noticed one of the other really bad times on the connection. It was because I had a PowerPoint that just seemed to hang up. I think there's something in there. It was just over 1 megabyte, so it wasn't large, and I didn't even think to run it through my DimDim. You know, I have a DimDim account I've tested things out on, and I didn't even think to run it through there because it was just such a small file. But I had that feeling where somehow the internet knew what I was up to. So anyway, that's crazy. Well, okay, that's it for me. You can roll it off anytime. Okay, very good. Okay, thank you, Cliff. Appreciate it. Very good work. Thanks for saving everything. Okay. Good deal. See you later. Bye-bye. Good night.